So Jesus looks different in some of these mirrors, but they're all out there. They're all out there, and I'm also work with the assumption that we pick up our software. Human beings pick up their software from the culture. And most of us do not distinguish very clearly between what we know formally from instruction and what we just pick up. Now you can see this process developing. Let me give you a more benign example, but I'm sure that I have always recently, when I teach the Gospels, tried to deal with the implicit Superman image that my students bring into the class, because I'm sure that the fundamental image of Jesus for many young adults is the image of somebody who, if you call him, will zap that which is going to hurt you. So he is something of a larger-than-life magician who calls for people. Jerry Bongard in Seattle had a wonderful story. The last time I was here telling about, he was trying to tell about how God helps you and is secure. The security motif is very important in the books of Psalms, but it just isn't the case in the New Testament that Jesus solves everybody's problems. He may make more problems than he solves. But anyhow, Jerry was telling his son about God, and he helps you, he cares for you. If you're in trouble, he comes to you. And his son pipes up and says, why don't we just call 911? So I think the subliminal image in our culture is of the 911 Jesus. You know, and whether it's Superman or teddy bear or what. So it's not that all of us, and sometimes it seems like that's the only Jesus you hear about in church. Even in Christian churches, the need of the community for consolation seems to take precedence often over the narrative of Jesus that we have in Mark or Matthew and so on. Okay, so my interest, you can see how my interest grows in the Jesus software that's kind of subconsciously embedded in people, as well as the Jesus software that people learn here and there in church and their own reading and so on. So you can kind of see what I'm about. So this trip, last week I did things with the Gospel of John, and this week I'm mostly kind of picking up different Jesus images that I know a little bit about, and trying to kind of get you started thinking about them. I understand education to be conversation. I mostly in my life have tried to start conversations, rarely finished any of them. And that's what I like about Holden, is that I can catch up on conversations that when I was here the last time. And so it's an ongoing. In fact, to tell you the truth, I had a course in scientific method in college that made me think that knowledge is always in process. That it isn't so much that we find out things that we have. I mean, if you look at the history of science and you see how things have changed, you know, they can't use the chemistry books today that they used 10 years ago. They just can't. They can't use the biology books that they used 10 years ago, and you see from the news reports that people are changing their mind about what we ought to do to stay healthy about, all the time. So maybe it's not just true of science, maybe the spirit keeps moving, maybe God has things for us to learn that we don't know yet. what would it be like if we thought of our knowing as part rather than the whole? So my notion of conversation fits then my epistemology, which is of us being human beings who are in process, and from the little bit of studying religion and studying the Bible that I've done in what has been still kind of a long life, you know, I'm another year and I'll be 70, and you know, I've been kicking around a couple of years, and so that I have become increasingly aware that I see a part rather than the whole, and so in this, in these cluster of things, I have been trying to engage you in seeing little pieces that you might not have thought about before, in the hopes that it starts some kind of conversation. And at the base is that I do not think God has finished with Christians, or Muslims, or Jews, or Americans, and we will learn many things in this next century that we have not dreamed of. Three concerns. No longer strangers. No longer strangers. Breaking down the walls. Now, my take on this today is that the way I want to put this is the basic commission for my Christian life is you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and strength and mind, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I think that sometimes in some of the communities that I share in, we emphasize mission so much that we forget the nurture of attitude and being, and that the testimonies we make to people who are not Christian will be far more useful to them if they come from people that have first shown that they know how to love them, rather than assume that somehow their message will change them if they don't show love. In my experience, in our culture, there is so much abuse, that it, when it comes to a basic level of trust, a basic level of trust, where you trust another person for life wisdom. It's one thing to buy a car. It's quite another thing to take a piece of wisdom for the other person and invest your life in it. You know, that's pretty high-risk stuff. So to trust the person at a deep level, they need to know that you have some positive attitude towards them. And anyhow, you get the drift here. So I am very much concerned about stereotypes of Muslims, Jews, Buddhists, pagans, atheists. I'm very concerned about the way that we in the Christian community have tended to caricature people, because I do not think we can even begin a conversation with people if the things we say about them are not really true, and are not true to their self-understanding. And so one of the first tasks in reaching out to others is to learn to understand, to learn to do dialogue. Let me put it another way. I think we have to take down the cement block walls in order to talk to people who are in different backyards. I think we need boundaries. I'm not saying that we all by ourselves change the boundaries. But there's a lot of difference between whether you have a boundary that's imagined online, some of you are old enough to remember what that was, or whether you have a boundary like we have with Canada that at least most of the time is fairly reasonable to go back and forth. Or if you want to see another kind of boundary, look at the boundary between Wisconsin and Minnesota. That's a boundary too, and our money comes from St. Paul and their money comes from Madison, but it's still a boundary. It's still a boundary. It still doesn't work. Bob is licensed to practice in Minnesota. Can you practice in California? Have you passed?
No.
No. So even with all of our jurisdictions, there are some places where you have very easy boundaries to cross and sometimes very difficult boundaries to cross, but most of us really don't need. I mean, when all is said and done, the world may not really need silos with nuclear weapons to maintain boundaries. And Christians and Jews and Christians and Muslims really may not need batteries of stereotypes in order to maintain, to honor the boundaries that exist between them. So don't confuse my interest in being neighbors with the issues that really define where the property line is, how we live our lives differently. For various reasons, we have very clear boundaries between our actual neighbors at our house in Northfield, but that doesn't mean we're uncivil or that we don't try to understand what they're real. Anyhow, you kind of get it. So my concern is with dialogue, this is particularly important because the United States more than ever before is becoming pluralistic. The American society that most of us come from are descendant of people who immigrated from Europe. Most of Europe is one brand or another kind of brand of Christianity. You know, granted some places it's Roman Catholic, some places it's Presbyterian, some places it's different kinds of Lutherans. My moment of truth was when I figured that all the Lutheran lands in Germany were not all the same kind of Lutherans. The reason we have different kinds of Lutherans in this country is because they came from different kind of Lutheran churches over there that have some of the same characteristics of the churches over here. Anyhow, that's it. So what I'm saying is now our immigration is from Arab countries, from Pakistan, from India, from the Orient. And so instead of seeing refracted and distorted images of people of faith of other cultures, we're finding very honorable, noble examples of people from other religious traditions. And some of our children are more interested in the other religious traditions than they are in our own, and so it's fairly important to begin to have a picture, a better picture of Muslims, for example, than you find in the newspaper. I mean, I still always see on the editorial page the cartoon of the Muslim terrorist. And when I ask a class what's the popular image you have of Muslims, they say terrorist. You know, at least some of them will say terrorist. Well, like most Muslims are more like Iowa Lutherans. They're relatively conservative, hardworking, very family-oriented. They're not at all like terrorists, you know? So this whole business of stereotyping is fairly important and so on. And that's why I get to teaching Islam and why I'm in, and the fact is that in the Quran there are Jesus stories. And so it's really important to know what your Muslim neighbor already believes about Jesus. There actually are more Muslims in the United States than Episcopalians. They're not as, the Muslim lobby or the Arab lobby is not nearly as well organized or financed as the Jewish lobby, but there are quite a lot of them. And in this century, before the year 2000, probably there will be more Muslims in the world than there will be Christians. The demographics are that the countries which are growing more rapidly, there's also some ways in which Muslim preaching is important for third world countries, has been very significant for third world countries, but a lot of it is demographic. The second thing that I'm concerned about, besides this business of dialogue and learning to understand and not be strangers to our neighbors, is the matter of the historical Jesus. There was a generation of Christians that assumed that the major problem was trying to affirm the divinity of Jesus because of the kind of philosophical tensions from the Western philosophical tradition. I have been persuaded that because of the students I have had who have had a lot of Jesus doctrine and very little Jesus experience, that one of the major issues is not having a picture of the humanity of Jesus, not having a sense of Jesus as a real human being. Now, the problem that this is for me is that I come out of the tradition of the theology of the cross, where God empties himself and becomes incarnate in human experience. And so the awesome thing about the gospel for me is how God could become human, not really about how I can, if I work hard enough, can become divine. So that if Jesus does, we do not sense the humanity of Jesus, those of us who are in Christian tradition will not imagine how gracious, the full graciousness of God. So that I have something of my understanding of the gospel at stake in this attempt to follow the trail of the historical Jesus, both in the Bible and outside of the Bible. Okay, having said that, what we really have in common with Muslims as Christians is the historical Jesus. Because they have and some Muslim apologetics get into that and so on. So anyhow, there is a sense in which there is a connection with my journey of conversing with people of other faiths that starts back in my own Lutheran experience of the gospel. But enough of that. I have three things that I want to clarify, and I may not get to all three of them, but I'd like to at least clarify some of them, lay a little bit down. I'm not a Islamicist. I'm not a Muslim, except insofar as all humans, and from a Muslim point of view, any person faithful to their vision of God is a Muslim with a small m, because they are trusting the word of God in certain sense. But I have spent I've spent 20 years answering questions about what Americans don't know about Muslims. And this session may turn, or we may end up after the session trying to clarify this and that attitude that you will run into in Muslims. Now, the three things, though, that I want to just mention are the differences between the life of Muhammad and the life of Jesus. The second thing I want to do is rehearse, at least briefly, the passages in the Quran that are about Jesus. So you will begin to see exactly how a devout Muslim thinks about Jesus. So you'll start where in your conversation where they are instead of where you think they are. Because Muslims are very devout and have a higher view of the Word of God in the Quran than Christians in relationship to the Bible. So it's fairly important to know these precise things that are in there. Then there is also, there's some Muslim apologetics which is making use of pieces of historical criticism that is done by secular humanists and Christians in this culture, and we may get to talking about that, but, you know, I'm more interested in our conversation than the material I bring in. You know, I take home always half of the stuff, unused half of the stuff I bring, so. Anyhow, the simple comparison of Jesus and Muhammad. Okay, Jesus born in about 4 BC. I better not do this, I might not get all the dates right. And his identity crisis is when he was in his 30s. And he had about a 3 to 4 year ministry. Okay, so he gets crucified in 34, Gospels are written in 70, etc., etc. Okay? So you see, what we know of Jesus is a young man, from my perspective, a relatively young man in his 30s who had a brief kind of involvement in politics and then was martyred and so on. And in many ways, for Christians, they've been figuring out what he was all about ever since, and certainly didn't get a burst of clarity until you get spirit and church and so on, okay? Now, it's a little bit different with Muhammad. He's an orphan. He's the date that I use to remember Muhammad is really 622. That's the date of the Hijra, or in the older transliterations, it's Hajira. There are all kinds of transliterations of Arabic, so don't be surprised if it's spelled one way in one book and one way in another. You really have to learn Arabic terms to keep Muslim world straight, because they label everything in Arabic. They think the only really inspired Quran is the one in Arabic. When I was on sabbatical studying Islam, I met a Muslim from India, and he had memorized the whole Quran in Arabic, and he couldn't speak Arabic because it's holy. And the recitation of the Quran in Arabic is the high point of holiness in Muslim prayer. So in functionally, the recitation of Quran comes almost to be what Holy Communion is for Christians. There are two kinds of analogies between religions. One is the thing itself, and the other, what looks alike. The other thing is how they work in their religious system. Religions are systems. They are not freestanding attitudes. They are systems. And so something over here does something different over here. That's why how the Quran works for Muslims, think Christ. Don't think Bible. Think Christ. The Quran works for Muslims like the Bible, like Christ works for Christians. It is the fundamental authority, and it is the center, you know, it's the nerve center of their system, of their world system. Okay. But that's when, well, let me start up. So, and Muhammad at this point is about 40. So Muhammad's ministry starts with a midlife crisis. And he has 10 years, 10 years where he's at Mecca. Which is across from, you know, from Africa, and 10 years where he's at Medina. Okay, and 40 years, and so there's some differences here. Now, the obvious difference, one of the most important things you got to realize is that Jesus really dies before his community gets off the ground. So the community gets off the ground and everything happens with the disciples and Jesus present in the spirit. Okay? So there is a kind of energy and a kind of creativity that happens to the disciples after Jesus is crucified and risen that is different over here. The major crisis for here's Hijra. The major crisis for Muslims is Hijra. The Muslim calendar is dated from the Hijra. This is the point. Muhammad was an orphan, grew up in his uncle's house, married a woman who was a trader. And about in his 40s, went out to a cave in the wilderness to pray and started having these voices. The word Quran is simply the word recite. So he has these oracles. If you want to understand the Quran, think Amos, think Isaiah, think one of the Hebrew prophets. The basic a phenomenological category of Muhammad is prophet. Okay? So, this, after the people that sort of privileged him and protected him from his enemies, he was fairly controversial because his early message is mostly an attack on the polytheism and the economic exploitation of religion in Mecca. And so those kind of people make people uncomfortable, and so they were trying to get rid of him, and then the people that protected him, his wife, his uncle, all of those people died off. And so the little communities of Muslims, one went to Abyssinia and then came to Medina. During the summer of 622, they kind of snuck away and landed in Medina. Now, Medina was in a political crisis, and so some of the people there, really wanted somebody who could come in and be the moral consultant to the government and get the warring factions in the city together. And so what really happened in Medina is that Muhammad became the teacher to, the Ayatollah to, a commonwealth, a city-state, and proceeded then to gradually elaborate how Islam applies to politics and everyday life. And then they went out and they rounded up all the other Arab tribal people. So the Islam was really responsible for taking a bunch of tribal peoples, like you see killing themselves in Central Africa today, and pulling them together into some kind of commonwealth organized around the justice of God. Now, the immediate import of this is that no Muslim is true to their tradition if they do not think about the relationship of the Word of God and lifestyle and the Word of God and politics. Very few people in the world, very few people, including Europe, have managed to separate secular authority from political authority from ecclesial authority. Because, of course, nobody really believes that faith has nothing to do with lifestyle and politics. We all know that what you believe in your heart ought to make a difference in the world. But then, often it doesn't, but we all hope it will, and we sure work hard to try to find ways that will make a difference in our communities. But you see, Muslims have it built into their vision and to their system. So they have a different kind of problem. There are different competitive Muslim visions, and so they have a lot of trouble with different movements. Most of these countries are, basically, you have in some of these countries going on a conflict between centrist Muslims or secular Muslims and radical right Muslims. Well, what's going on in our politics? But conflicts between left, middle, and right. But we happen to have a system that favors the middle, and you get elected by kind of moving towards the middle. Not all people who don't have democratic societies and know how to, two things. You can have a democratic society on paper, but you may not know how to make it work. So people who have a system that is democratic and the smarts to make it work are few and far between around. So this sort of explains how Muslim gets into the politics of these countries. And there's country after country where the internal parties, kinds of Muslims, are a factor in the political. And that's you see, their lives were very different, and also the discipline since Muhammad really was a leader of the community, he also had a role in forming the spiritual discipline of Muslims. And Muslims who may not agree politically and may not speak the same language and may have culturally very little in common, practically all will do the five pillars. Five pillars. There are five parts in the catechism that we use, and Muslims are tied together because they have a praxis. They fundamentally think that human beings are mildly misguided at the best, and they all need direction. They all need direction. So the community is a school in which you learn how to be a observant Muslim. And there are five things that observant Muslims do worldwide in different languages. The Shahada, God alone is God, and Muhammad is his prophet. Salat, prayer. And they just don't leave it to people praying once in the week. If you're an observant Muslim, you do it five times a day. One of the kind of inspiring things is when you run into, you're in Cairo, you know, and here's a man who has his hands dirty. He's a construction worker, and he puts down his little rug. You know, you don't pray only. If you need a holy place, you bring your rug along with you. That makes any place holy. And so you get down and say your prayers, and then you go back to work. It's that simple.
Is the rug itself, does it carry any characteristics, or are your knees not to touch the ground, or what? Can you explain a little what the purpose of the...
Functional comment I want to make. It just functions like a church. It takes a piece of church with you. But yes, once it's been used for special things, it gets to function like your special Bible that you got on confirmation, or somebody might give you a prayer rug, and there are designs. The rug should face in the direction of Mecca. And so it gets to, like any prayer gesture, we close our eyes, and every community tries to find ways to make space, I mean, urban, you know. We live here, we can walk out in the woods or go to church or something, but most people have lived in cities and villages, and so if you're going to pray, you're going to have to psychologically create a space for prayer. And so there are different rituals. So the prayer rug becomes part of the ritual, which is readying. The most significant thing, that if you see these same people going to a mosque, the other ritual which they use in preparing for prayer is washing. You know, so to be at Al-Aqsa in Jerusalem and see this workman come, and he has a little trough and puts his feet, and he cleans off his feet, and he washes off the dust off his hands, and then he'll splash some stuff over on his face. Well, you know, washing is a wonderful ritual of readiness. You know, I still think that the people that had somebody who made them take a bath on Saturday night, they started getting ready for church on Saturday night. They didn't start getting ready for church 5 minutes before the bell rang. You know, the thing that I'm amazed with the Muslims, this practical kind of system for doing it is just built into their culture and their training. So actually, in terms of ritual, more people in more societies maintain traditional ritual in Muslim countries than, you know, there was a day when Christians did these things. We had church bells, they had the call to prayer. We had rituals, you know, you had at least prayers twice a day in most families. And maybe you had personal prayers too, there was more prayer, anyhow, you get the picture. Anyhow, it's held on among Muslims. Okay, Salat is prayer, Zakat is their version of tithing. You're supposed to do 2.5% of your profit. It's the general rule, and it means that taking care of your neighbors is built in. I've met a Muslim from Yemen, and he says, part of my zakat is to concern myself with the fourth family there. This means in a functioning Muslim village or small community, there will be someone that sees that you always have something to eat. And I'm sure that there will never be starving in Egypt like there is in India, because they cannot be true to their traditions. So they'll subsidize bread to the hilt before anybody will starve to death in a Muslim country. And it's cultivated by zakat. It means they have foundations called waqf and so on, that are around and do benevolences, and the Saudi foundations of WAQ are supporting all the Muslim ecumenical stuff in this country, and that's why much Islam in this country is coming out more conservative than most Islam is because some of the money is coming. That's part of the politics of Muslim community has politics too. So it's not just Christians. Zakat, Zaum, fasting. Fasting, there's 1 month in the Muslim calendar called Ramadan. During Ramadan, I mean, they don't do anything kind of really crazy. They just do things that are mildly rigorous. But, you know, they don't say you don't eat during Ramadan. What they say is you don't eat before sunrise, after sunrise, and you don't eat until after sunset. So it means you got to get up early and have your breakfast before the sun comes up, and you've got to wait till after. Now, you can imagine what it's like if you're a Muslim in Norway in summer. Or vice versa, but I'm sure they are very pragmatic about the whole thing. If you're sick or pregnant or something, you adapt it to your own to your to the needs, because this, of course, the fasting is not for God. The fasting is for us.
One of the powerful examples is Hakeem Olajuwon, basketball player, was fasting during the playoffs or during one of the really important games in the whole series. And, you know, basketball is very, very rigorous, and I guess he could drink water, but that was it. And it was amazing, the kind of the testimony that he gave to a lot of people about his, the importance of his faith.
The analogy I use to give people a peephole on Ramadan is, and of course, no ritual works all, if you look at Christian church services and know how many are alive and how many feel dead, you will know that no ritual in any religion works 100% of the time. But when it's working, it's a little bit like, you know how magical Christmas Eve is? Because all magical things are done in the dark. And it's sort of like turning day into night, and so everything, all this fun stuff happens at night, and you, after the fast is over, you get together and have a special meal, and you visit friends, and I met a Muslim person who basically, she would watch television all night and then sleep during the daytime. And anyhow, but what intrigued me about my Muslim students was, they are learning to say no. They're learning to say no. And other people go on with their lives. So there is an actual discipline built into their ritual, a self-discipline built into their ritual. And I find one of the most debilitating things about our culture is that people are gather so much, and many of our young people have no idea of how to say no to anything. They just don't. And here it is built into the system. Anyhow, and Hajj, of course, is pilgrimage to Mecca. Well, it's the, in my vernacular, it's Muslim Bible camp. And it's pretty good. It works pretty well. Mecca's in Arabia, and it's, it used to be that people didn't go more than once. They could never afford to go more than once in their life. And if you came back from camp, or from Hajj, then you were a special figure in your community, kind of an elder, and you could even draw something on your house, and you would always be called Haji. And I've heard Muslims argue about Mecca. About Hajj. There was a fellow from Bangladesh and a fellow who was American, and they were arguing about going on Hajj because the fellow from Bangladesh said, and you know that no Muslim should go on Hajj until everybody in his country has bread. Okay, so you can see the kind of theological arguments that you can get out of Hajj. Anyhow, that's, okay, back to...
Why Mecca instead of Medina?
What?
Why Mecca instead of Medina?
I sometimes say things rather flippantly because it's the easiest way for people to understand them, but I'm not at all, I don't have an irreverent attitude about it, because I think God's providence, we were doing a piece of the Jacob cycle in Genesis at Bible study this morning, and I started reading past the Bible study and read all this stuff that Jacob did to get two wives, and all of it's a very elaborate story. Of course, one of the points of the story is that Jacob has to end up with 12 kids or you won't have 12 tribes. You know, so the way that happened is really kind of horrendous, really, from our point of view. But read it sometime. It's a kind of thriller, actually. Anyhow, why Mecca? The question is Mecca. I got to answer his question first. I didn't answer his question. Okay, it's Mecca because there was real hostility in Medina, and Muhammad made a deal with Mecca that involved putting pilgrimage to the Kaaba, which is the central shrine in Mecca. So Muhammad was willing to say we can keep these old mysterious shrine. We can keep this and get people to go to Mecca and all the prophet, you know, the things that would keep Mecca in business, but it's going to be done on the Muslim terms, namely. The shrine is not a place where you worship God, who is awesomely transcendent. That's another story, but awesomely transcendent. The Kaaba, it's a place where you pray, and actually on Hajj, you do there, you go out in the wilderness and throw stones at the devil, which is one of the stories, and you go where, you go to a spring where Hagar, you know, when Hagar was sent out of Abraham, sent away. See, they understand themselves to be descendants of Hagar. And so there are certain stories that reenact their heritage. All right, Bob, you're next.
What do they do at Mecca, Vernon? How long are they there? Do they basically go to worship them?
It's basically 3 days, and they make a spiritual retreat. They basically make a retreat. They go in, check into a hotel, and then they're out in the course. It only lasts a month. You can only do this in 1 month. And you go and you... You take off. Mecca's the original revelations, not the original, that's the original. But Mecca reminds me of that. You know that Revelations text where you see all people around the throne of the Lamb and they're white robed and no person can number? Well, that's what happens in Mecca. Everybody puts on white clothes and you, it's a big campground and they just had a fire or something there this year. And this place they're speaking Chinese, and this place they're speaking Indian. Incidentally, the country with the largest Muslim population in the world is Indonesia. Now think about that. It also has the largest Lutheran church in the world, and so Lutherans better know something about Muslims and vice versa. Okay, so you've got all these different languages and all these, and they're all doing the same ritual. They're all basically doing this. Now, did I answer your question? So he made a deal so the Kaaba got filled in and Mecca became the pilgrimage center. And Mecca was kind of the holy city because that's where he had his first, near there was where he had his first revelations and so forth. Okay, now let me get to the Quran. And I'm going to do it, and I have some of the quotes in the articles. I never quite got to getting a Quran out of the library, but I've got some of the quotes if you want to hear the quote exactly. Jesus is basically seals the compassion of God. The Muslim, almost every chapter or surah in the Quran starts with, in the name of God, the all-merciful, the all-compassionate. Okay? Took me a long time coming out of a faith works Lutheran apologetic to begin to understand that from the Muslim point, yes, there's a lot of focus on action, doing. This is a system for coaching action. Muslim means being observant. That in fact they understand all the energy and the pattern and all the incentive to action to basically come from the mercy of God. The energy we have to do good works is a result of the mercy of God, not just for God's sake, but for our sake. Okay, so in a very there are plenty of Muslims who will act like, just like, you know, ask people what's important to you about being a Christian, and they'll tell you about their good works. You know, there are plenty of Muslims that are going to tell that seem like they're keeping score. But there are plenty of Christians who keep score too, you know, and If there weren't Christians who keep score, we'd have a far harder time raising capital funds. So just a mild bit of incentive or little bit helps a lot when you're trying to get that pocketbook to open wide instead of just tight. Anyhow, they've made a lot out of the virgin birth story. And they see in the virgin birth story a real providence. Oh, one more thing about Jesus as a son. Most Muslims have a theory of prophecy. They, since Jesus and all these people are in the Quran, they come with a ready-made view of Christians. Since Muhammad is not in the New Testament, we don't come with a ready-made view of Muslims. So every Muslim knows something about Christians, and most Christians know zero or minus 10 about Muslims. They know the things that are not true about Muslims rather than anything about Muslims. So anyhow, in the theory of prophecy, every tribe has their prophet. There are epic-making prophets. Moses, Abraham, Jesus are all epic-making prophets. And then you'll notice where we get to the fence. The final prophet is Muhammad. Okay? Just like with the Christian, the incarnation of God is in Jesus, not in Moses. So again, they have their way. The buck stops with the Quran for the Muslim. The buck stops with Jesus for the Christian. And so, but you see, just like Moses can be part of our tradition, Jesus can be part of the Muslim tradition, and he is one of the early prophets. You see, and so Muslims respect as holy Old Testament and New Testament. They don't read it a lot, and they read it with Quranic eyes. Okay, so anyhow, the sign. They honor the virgin birth story. They like Mary. She's a, and so on. John the Baptist is there. Jesus' teaching is about gospel, good news, Torah. He preaches about sincerity, humility. He preaches basically faith in God. Don't be distracted by the term Allah. Allah. Allah is simply the generic word for God. When Christians who speak Arabic talk about God, they'll say Allah. And when Muslims who speak English translate things into their vernacular, they'll say God, because it's just the generic word for God. So he's a wonderful example of humility, of service of God, of being a servant of God, which is of trusting God and the essence of Salam. Islam is the religion of Salam. Salam is then trust and obedience to God. There's an interesting verse which is fascinating. They read, you know, when the New Testament talks about the coming of the Comforter, the Counselor, the one who continue to teach the truth? Well, for some Muslims, that's Muhammad. Okay? So you see, they'll piggyback. Just like we have the Holy Spirit to account for the changes, they in fact have Muhammad to account for the renovation or reformation of the tradition. The tradition of monotheism, because Muslims and Jews and Christians and Zoroastrians and a few others, we all stand in a tradition in which there's only one God. And whereas we have seen some complexity in that unity, Muslims are probably even more than Jews enthralled and amazed and disciplined by the notion of the unity of God. Now that then leads them to, because they are concerned about the unity of God, because they are concerned about idolatry or shirk, thou shalt have no other gods before me, they react to those pieces of Christian tradition which seem to them to compromise the transcendence of God. Okay? Now, one is a very strange one, and I didn't really get it for a long time. The Muslim believes that Jesus was taken to God. He did not die. The Quran says that Jesus did not die. He was taken to God, rather like Elijah. Why? Because God does not allow his prophets to finally be hurt. God takes care of his prophets. And it's a Muslim story that's rather like the, you know, Elijah being taken away, and a kind of special protection for a person who has had a very difficult task to do. So it's, in many ways, the boundary, and you know, of course, resurrection doesn't mean much if Jesus hasn't died. So there's a thing, and so the boundary between Jews and between Christians and Muslims, it's right built into the Quran and to the New Testament. I mean, you don't have to work to keep Muslims and Christians apart. There's very little chance of them accidentally drifting. If they cross the boundary, it's because of something that each of them sees in the other faith. The second thing, of course, that their shirk sense of idolatry leads them, when they hear Christian talk about the Trinity, or Jesus as the Son of God, meaning Jesus as divine, actually originally Son of God meant Jesus was Messiah, it was a title for David. But in Christian tradition, it has come to signify the divinity of Jesus. So the Son of God talk and the Trinity talk has, in classic Muslim-Christian relations, been the troubling language. And so there's a verse in the Quran about Trinity and about Jesus as the Son of God. I saw one for a while. The ALC Mission Board had commissioned several theologians, and they were trying to get theologians to see if they could talk about Jesus without using the term Son of God and Trinity. You know, they were trying to get. You don't always have. It, sometimes the words, the words get all loaded. And so the words are like waving a red flag in front of people. And when you get in that kind of situation, you try to find other words to say the same thing. I figured out when I was in a parish in Chicago, if I used the word sin, I would turn people off. They would close their ears. But if I would talk about real sins, then they might perk up their ears. So I gave up the word sin. But I've been talking about sin and repentance and about just about everything I do ever since. But not all the people don't always know that's what I'm talking about. But anyway, so that's kind of the Muslim, the verses that are in the Quran, and it means every devout Muslim has a respect for Jesus, maybe even a love for Jesus, thinks that Jesus is a gift of God and was part of the plan of God. And so they will approach us with at least some understanding, and that's more than most of us muster when we start listening to them. Now there's a curious thing since...
One quick question. How did Muhammad die, or did they believe he was taken up as a prophet?
No. He died a natural death.
So they didn't...
In about 10 years after he did, he was in Medina, yeah.
So they didn't elevate him to heaven in the...
No, but he wasn't killed. He wasn't killed by his enemies. He died a natural death.
Thank you.
So God did not abandon Muhammad. There's a wonderful... Muslims have the Quran. That's the word of God. Muslims also have about 20 books of hadith, which is an Arabic word for story, and these are Muhammad stories. So that very quickly the Quran was pulled together. There were a couple hundred years where they told Muhammad stories. And of course, some of them get kind of even more elaborate than some of the stories in the Apocrypha about Jesus. And they ended up with about 200,000 Muhammad stories, and then they had to have a big science of hadith to try to sort out which of these are authentic stories and which aren't. And part of the differences in Muslim theology depend upon whether you, if you want a more radical Islam, you build it out of the Quran and distance yourself from the hadith. Just like you get a more radical Christianity out of the Bible than you do from the Bible and the creeds. And so there's something of that going on in the hadith process. Now, one of the interesting things that has happened recently is that when Muslims read some of the historical criticism of academic sites and all this emphasis on the historical Jesus and how the church, in some people, the church sort of, for some people, the church, the spirit and the church helped us understand Jesus. For some people, the so-called fall of the church theory, the spirit and the church betrayed Jesus. And part of the differences between central and left-wing Christians have to do with whether you understand the creeds as betrayal of the and Bible as authentic of the authentic Jesus. So Muslims see this then as proof that the Quran has the right idea, because they emphasize the humanity of Jesus, the historical character of Jesus. And so from my point of view, when you're trying to recover the historical Jesus, you end up having that reinforced by the Muslim view of Jesus, although certainly. And the other thing is that for them, Muhammad is Jesus is a prophet. And of course, like for example, that Jesus of Montreal film, one of the real difficult, the Jesus that the Christians have suppressed is the troublesome Jesus. We have the tender words of Jesus. But we sort of leave out the Jesus that got himself killed because he was disturbing the peace and challenging the uses of power in his society. And that prophet-like Jesus, so I'm perfectly willing to say, and I think most Christians need to say, that Jesus was a prophet. But he was more than a prophet for Christians, not less than a prophet. So some Christians, in emphasizing other aspects of Jesus, subtract prophet, and I think we ought to replicate the experience of early Christians, which is come to a understanding of the ways in which God used the prophet Jesus made him more than a prophet for the Christian community. Is this a place where we should? I think this is a place where we'll formally cut off the tape, and then I can continue to chat about things. So you see the thing of Muslim apologetics, how they will use historical. But of course, the funny part is that, of course, any scholar who is interested in the historical Jesus thinks Jesus died. So what the Muslim does is use this piece of historical research, but not this piece. Well, now try to explain that subtlety to somebody who has gone to a Muslim meeting and this sort of thing. And the other thing is that Muslim men are moral and dependable and reliable are reasonably attractive to Christian women. So we're having more and more Muslim, not just Christian Jewish families, we're having more and more Muslim Christian families. And my guess is that if you live long enough, you'll see almost every family will end up having a mixed marriage, a divorce, a gay person, and something else in their family. And then some of this business of stereotyping will get over it. Did due season. I mean, there was an article I read which was saying that Nobody's pure race. You know, look at Tiger Woods. He's Oriental, he's black, he's something else. Well, Tiger Woods is the American of the future. Who's gonna be a tossed salad. And so, in a sense, that may solve the problem of whites and blacks, because when all is said and done, the blacks are at the bottom of the pile in all this structural oppression. Anyhow, you're in question.
On your Sadaha,
Shahada.
God alone is God, Muhammad is his prophet. Is this a prayer, a statement? What? It's a pillar, but is this just kind of a mantra that is...
It has used? The same status for Muslims that Jesus Christ is Lord has for Christians.
Okay.
And so it functions as the cornerstone, the first one, God is God, which is anchors them in a supremely overpowering vision of the transcendence, mystery, awesomeness, bigness, majesty, name it what you will, and unity of God. So if God is one, then anything which compromises the unity of God is idolatry. Whether it's other religions, the idolatry that I see among some Muslims and the idolatry I see, it's very interesting because associating with Muslims have reinforced certain aspects of my Christianity, but it's also made me aware of some Christian sins, which I hadn't planned on. But the idolatry that I see many Muslims engaging in is to make Islam, to worship Islam instead of God. And I see the same thing among Christians. They worship the church rather than, or they become church-centered in a way that makes, that somehow they compromises the unity. Now, I think for contemporary neo-Orthodox Christians who have emphasized Christology and Christ as the knowledge of God, this has tended to aggravate the distance between Muslims and Christians. whereas classical Christians, by and large, had a more full-blown Trinitarian thought in which they could, where you can see some bonding between Christians and Muslims on the basis of either the doctrine of God or at least imagine a relationship between Christians and Muslims in terms of either the doctrine of God or the doctrine of the Holy Spirit.
Is God masculine? Muhammad is his prophet? Or is that an issue in Islam?
No, of course not. God is pre-existent, transcendent, so that the unity of God will protect them from the use of anthropomorphism. Both Jews and Christians use the anthropomorphic imagery of the early stories in the Bible. It's amazing to me how many people, if you try to take the gospel literally, I mean, if you try to take the Bible literally, it's amazing how funny things we get into if we try to see the patriarchal image of God in Genesis as a paradigm for our understanding of God, as though there was no development of revelation and as though the experience of the people taught people nothing about how to understand God. We're talking about the unity of God. There was something else in your question that I got.
Well, it's the language about, you know, there's still a lot of controversy in Christian circles about inclusive language.
Oh, inclusive language. No, the other thing I want to say something else about that. There is not as large a contingent, because the largest contingent of feminism is in the first world. There are certain kinds of injustice that simply are not faced when you don't have as much money as we have. And in a sense, the abusiveness between males and of males towards females in North American society can come out of the closet now that women have the ability to earn to earn their own income in a way that has not been characteristic of people. So they're, for example, they're Egyptian, they're feminists in third world countries, but they say we got to have work before we start on the women's issues. It's more, bread is more important than freedom. And the other thing is, so that there are strong Muslim feminists in many countries. The women got the vote in Egypt, for example, about the same time that women got the vote in the United States. Remember that women, and we may have been recently more liberated, but my grandmother, great-grandmother could not vote, and so on. So that our insights, and when the United States was formed, there were slaves, and maybe still are, people who are economically oppressed.
Do they have a tradition of congregational life and preaching like Christians do? Would they have heard Jesus preached about or anything like that?
Yes. I'm trying to help you clean up your language.
Okay.
Teach you language so that when you talk to Muslim, you don't you get onto the real issues, not just the stumble around. Christians go to churches. Muslims go to mosques. Jews go to synagogues, even if they're called temples.
Okay.
Reformed temples are not really temples like Temple Mount in Jerusalem. They are synagogues. Okay, so they all have a different name for their building, but they all call the people that gather in the building congregations. So you're safe if you use the word congregation. They all have congregations. He also asked a question about preaching. Yes, Protestants will have no who are word-oriented and forget about the bread and wine, will have no difficulty understanding Muslims. There's a special high pulpit in every mosque, okay? And there's a niche on the wall because it's the Qibla, which is the direction Mecca. So you got to pray in the right direction, and the services. When you go to the Muslim mosque for prayer, what they will include are ritual, and they're also body people. You know, they don't think you worship God just with the top of your head, okay? And they're also conservative because they don't want you to use stimulants, you know, no alcohol, and some of them don't even use coffee. Anything that, if God has given you a mind, don't do anything to interfere with clarity of mind, whatever, okay? And so they will get down on their knees, they will go down. If you see a really prayerful Muslim, there'll probably be a callus right there. And do that, and then they'll get back, and they'll... So that is called a raka. And each of the orders, like Matins and Vespers, basically their service is a Matin Vesper service. And so it includes action, the action of prayer, and it includes formally the reading of Quran. They will have one of the art forms in Muslim cultures is the chanting. It's like plain song, you know. It's so that there are certain high forms of Muslim chanting. And there's so many schools of chanting and so forth. It has become a kind of musical form almost. And also the making of script out of the Quran is an art form, so Muslim script. And I'm not positive how much preaching they do at daily prayers, but the major service of the week is Friday noon prayers, and there's always a major sermon. There's always a major sermon, very often in some places it's political. If you go, when we went to Al-Azhar Mosque in Egypt, which is one of the most prestigious and the Imam of that mosque. Imam in Sunni Islam, Imam is simply the leader of the congregation. Okay? And this normally in Muslim countries means that they're educated and trained, but the Imam in the little mosque in Minneapolis is a person who's engineer or something on the side, and he's Imam on their prayer service. And the Imam, there was set up a little television studio where the Imam's sermon was broadcast on television. So in a Muslim country, when Friday prayers comes, it'll be on all the loudspeakers, it'll be on all the television sets and the radio. So yes, they are used to preaching.
That's interesting. There's Friday noon is the main one. Do they keep a Sabbath or Shabbat? Did that come along?
That's my prescription for reducing unemployment is to have three holy days. You take Friday off for the Muslims, you take Saturday off for the Jews, you take Sunday off for the Christians, and then you would have a four-day work week. And then we could cover each other's holy day and distribute the work. Because most of the intelligent people I know, they want to work hard, but they don't want to work all the time and turn into a workaholic like their fathers. And so they really would like a shorter work week. Well, we ought to figure it out how the people who are young and creative could have a shorter work week. And not wait till we retire to have a shorter work week.
Well, Bert, I'm still unclear on the Quran. The Quran again is, you had a phrase for it. It is made up of
surahs.
Okay. Which are?
Like chapters.
Okay.
The surahs are the divisions of the Quran. And the Quran is made up of the sermons and oracles of Muhammad.
Muhammad
himself. But they do not treat the Quran as though it were evidence for a Muhammad biography, because the Quran is inspired preaching of Muhammad. So scholars, Western scholars, will use the Quran to get an idea of what Muhammad thought, but from the point of view of Islam, it's the scripture. It is wherever it came from. It is the holy book and inspired, and you use it to find the will of God.
And in the Quran are these various pieces about Jesus that is included in the Quran. So the inspiration of it, that particular person or that figure, Jesus, was important along with Moses or Abraham or whatever.
Yes. If it was not in the Quran, it would be easy to change. But for example, because the fact that Jesus didn't die is in the Quran, and it's connected to a polemical story which says that the death of Jesus is a false story made up to show that God is not powerful. Because of that, it's just impossible. I mean, Muslims who even know better don't even think of changing it.
What sources would Muhammad have had for his knowledge of Jesus? Were they Christian scriptures? Or?
They make a great deal of Muhammad being illiterate, so it's unlikely that he read Christian scriptures, but there were Christians in the Hijaz, and there were Christian communities. The Muslim community went to Abyssinia, who had a Christian king, and the people from Mecca said, don't take these people in, they'll spoil things, and he listened to them, and he said, well, you worship the same God, so I have to take you in. So a group of them lived in Abyssinia for a while. The Muslim trade fairs had all kinds of people come to them. They were fairly traders, you know, are a long way from home. Plus, this is Byzantine Christianity. So a lot of the things that early Muslim stories have are fairly true to the kind of Christianity that they saw around them.
So like Jesus made it, but Paul didn't, apparently, into the Quran.
Yeah, they didn't. And of course, Jesus is a story in the Quran, and the Paul is teachings. So Paul isn't really that much of a figure in the New Testament. He is important largely because we have autographed documents from Paul. I mean, things that he really thought up, whether he had a secretary or not. So we have actual sayings from Paul, and he's in the book of Acts a little bit, but no, Paul is not important. But Paul is that would make an interesting series, because Paul is really the dividing line between Christians and Jews. Jews can make, Jesus is a perfectly good Jew boy. It's Paul that sort of gets things, you know, so it's fair. I don't think this is accurate historically, the best way to look at it, but it's fairly easy to see the problems of Christianity as arising with the movement of Christianity to the Gentile world. The things you don't like about Christianity, for example, the popular one now, most of us really see anti-Semitism as emerging with Constantinian and Imperial Christianity. Imperial Christianity did a lot to corrupt and destroy some of the earlier senses of community that Christians who are a minority in their society really had. That's why the Bible has been very extremely important for every reform movement in Christianity, because most of us have found in the New Testament a kind of Christianity that's a little bit different than the churches are practicing, or the church where we grow up is practicing. And so the New Testament provides us with the best tutoring of the reforming imagination.